spent 4 years going to college.
Morning, everyone. Excuse me. Today's daf is daf Nun Gimel. We are on the bottom of Nun Beis Amud Aleph. Thank the Lupin Foundation for sponsorship of the daf. Daf is learning Lezeich Nishmas Libur Gavriela Bashmuel. We are speaking about the Ksuva. A couple of stipulations that are made within the Ksuva, and we are focusing right now on the stipulation that if she is taken captured, so you have an obligation to ransom her, to redeem her. The clause that's written in the Ksuva is that in the event, I'll read it from the Mishnah, so Kasav, Lo Kasav Lan Tishbe in Tish. So the Mishnah says that if you don't write the clause that if you are taken captured, I'm going to redeem you and I'm going to bring you back as my wife, or the Mishnah goes on and gives a different clause that are written by the Kohanim, or if you're a Kohen, what you're going to write is that I'm going to return you back to your father's house, meaning unfortunately I can't take you back, you're captured and violated, and an anusa is prohibited to her Kohen, her husband Kohen. So these are the two clauses that are going to be written in the Ksuva by the husband. And the Mishnah's point is that even if he doesn't write these clauses, so nevertheless, these are they're going to be valid clauses. Our big discussion that we had yesterday, machlokas between Abai and Rava, is what if the marriage is such where he can't take her back home? Meaning, not a Kohen, but we're talking about, let's say a man married someone who was prohibited to him, and he can't take her back. He shouldn't have married her to begin with, okay? But we're I don't know if we're over that yet. But in other words, just that's just the reality. And now that she was taken captured, so if he redeems her, he's not going to take her home. So does he have an obligation to redeem her? So that was a big discussion that we had yesterday, is machlokes between Abai and Rava. So Rava's position, which is the halachically accepted position, is no. Under such circumstances, he does not have an obligation to redeem her. In other words, because he can't take her home, so therefore it invalidates the whole clause, and therefore he does not have an obligation to redeem her altogether. And we went into a discussion yesterday in Machlokas Tanaim, Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Yoshua, regarding a scenario where in the middle of the marriage they become prohibited to one another. What becomes of that? But the halacha falls like Rava. We're going to pick it up right where we left off yesterday. Nishbez Chayv Levdosa. If she is captured, so he has to redeem her. Tan Rabbanan. We're on the bottom of Nun Beis Amud Aleph at the two dots. Nishbez Bechayv Bala V'achar Kach Meis Bala. So let's say that she was captured while the husband was alive, and unfortunately the husband didn't get a chance to redeem her yet. And so now the question is, does the estate need to redeem her? Hikar Babala Yoshin Chayev Levdosa. So if the husband knew about it before he died, so then the children have an obligation, the estate has an obligation to redeem her. Lo Hikar Babala, but if the husband did not know about her being captured, and Yoshin Chayev Levdosa, so then the children / the estate does not have to redeem her. So Levi Savalameh Beruvi Kiyam Masnisa. Okay, so according to the Braisa, the critical point is his awareness. If he knows that his wife was captured, so then that creates an obligation for both him and his estate. If he didn't know about his wife being captured, and then he dies, so then his estate is exempt. So Levi heard this Braisa, Levi learned the Braisa, Levi thought, okay, that's the halacha. So what happened? Amalei Rav. So Rav says, you know, the uncle of Rav was Rabbi Chia. So Rav says that my uncle says that the halacha does not fall like this braisa. Elaki haditanya. But rather my uncle tells me that he has another braisa, and the halacha falls like his braisa, which is nishbeis acher mises baala, and he has a mechayav levdosa v'lo od. If she was captured after the death of her husband, so then there's no obligation to redeem her. And not only that, ela afilu nishbeis bechayav baala v'acher kach meis baala, and he has a mechayav levdosa. So, and furthermore, even if she was captured while the husband was alive, but he did not have the opportunity to redeem her prior to his death, the estate has no obligation to redeem her. In other words, it's only an obligation on the husband to redeem her, and it's not an obligation on the estate. And why should that be? And again, everything comes back to the clause that's written in the Ksuva. I mean, this is real contract law. Meaning that the clause that's written in the Ksuva is, I'm going to redeem you to bring you back to my house. Well, that's not going to happen if he's no longer alive. The estate can redeem her, but the estate's not going to bring her back as a wife. So because you cannot comply with the second half of the clause, so therefore the first half of the clause is no longer in force. So in other words, the Rav Chia says that this obligation of redeeming her is only on the husband and not on the estate. Tan Rabbanan, the Gemara quotes another braisa. Let's say she was captured and they're asking for an exorbitant amount of money for her. 10 times more than her value. So upon Rishon Apoda. So according to the Tanakhama of this Braisa, okay, you're on the hook. Meaning you are contractually obligated to redeem her, and therefore you must redeem her. Mikan Ve'elech, Ratz Apoda, Ratz Ein Apoda. Now, after that point in time, she's captured again. So no, that now you have an option. When I say no, I meaning no, you don't have to redeem her, but now at this point in time, you have an option. If you want to, you can redeem her, but if you want to, you could just simply pay off the ksuva, and that would be sufficient. So that's the opinion of Tanakhama. Two things to point out. Number one, the obligation of redeemer is like a game of Monopoly, right? Everyone's familiar. It's like you get out of jail free card, but it only works once. Meaning that the ksuva obligation to redeemer is only a one time requirement. It doesn't afford her the ability to get redeemed time and again if she's captured multiple times. So that's after the first time, it simply becomes optional on the part of the husband. But that's excuse me. That's point number one. Point number two is the Gemara and Gittin. The Gemara and Gittin says Tosfos over here is raises the Gemara and Gittin. The Gemara and Gittin goes into a discussion fifth parak about redeeming captors. Right, I know it's a very contemporary issue. It's a very serious issue, and unfortunately, nowadays we don't redeem our captures with money. But okay, let's keep it to the Gemara. So the Gemara in Gittin says that when you redeem somebody, so as part of Tikkun Olam, right? Oh, there are a bunch of Mishnayos in the fifth parak of Gittin that discuss enactments that were made by the Chachamim in order to create Tikkun Olam, to basically create some sort of decency. Common sense, how do I say it? In other words, so that we can function. Right, that's it. Functionality of society. So one of them is that if somebody's taken captive, so one of the Tikkun Olams that are instituted over there is that you cannot overpay for a captor. Okay, the Gemara over there in Gittin gives a couple of explanations of why that should be. But in other words, you cannot overpay for a captor. So Tosfos is bothered by a very simple question. Over here, what are we learning? That if your wife is taken captive and they're asking for an exorbitant fee, so you pay it, meaning the first time you pay it, even 10 times more than what she's worth, you still pay it. So to which Tosfos is bothered, our Gemara over here doesn't conform with the Gemara in Gittin. Take a look at Tosfos. It's the third Tosfos on the Amud. The Im Tomer Avahad Dabai Peperka Shalecha Adanan In Podnus Shvin Yosem Ichdei Demem Im Neitikin Olam. The Mishnah in Gittin says that you cannot overpay for a captive because of Tikkun Olam. Im Yishem Duchad Ditzibora. So Tosfos over here, we're going to go over this quickly. So Tosfos says one of the reasons why you cannot overpay for a captive is because it causes too much of a stress on the community, where the community is now going to be expected to front the money every single time someone's taken captive, and it's going to just be such a financial strain on the community. Or you're going to encourage them to do it again, meaning that if they're going to not only get paid for capturing, but they're going to get overpaid, so you're just going to stir the pot and basically motivate them to do it again. So how then, asked Tosfos, can we learn together right now that if your wife is taken captive, you can pay 10 times that amount? The Mishum Duchu Disipur Dictani Deportes Adasar Bedama Vieshlamar, the Afila Tam de la Ligra Velezu Tfe, Lota Kinishala Yuchel of Dos Adam Esat Smo, Yosemichte Damav, Shere Orbad Or Vechola Shalishi Timbad Navshal. Tosos writes that even though the Mishnah in Gittin puts a cap on how much you can redeem, that's talking about how much you can redeem other people. But in terms of redeeming yourself, meaning let's say you're held captive, and out of your own pocket, you want to pay with your own money, out of your own pocket, you want to pay your own ransom, you can pay whatever you want. So Tosfos says, based on the Gemara in Gittin, that that's not under the Tikkun Olam umbrella, you can pay your way out. And Tosfos says, Vahacha, Isho Kagufo. And over here, we're talking about ransoming of your wife, that is tantamount to ransoming of yourself. So just like you can overpay to ransom yourself, so too you can overpay to ransom your wife. That is how Tosfos explains the discrepancy between our Gemara and the Gemara in Gittin. Let's go back to our Gemara. We're on the very bottom of Nun Beis Amud Aleph. So again, Tanakhama says that if your wife is taken ransom, is captured, you can ransom, you can and must ransom her 10 times her value. But that's only the first time. After that, it's optional. Now, but the option is either you ransom her or you give her the ksuva. You pay the ksuva. Rav Shimon Gamliel Omer, second opinion, nun beis top now, nun beis amid beis. Ein poz neshashvin yoser al kidei demehem. So Rav Shimon Gamliel says, you never pay more than the value of a person. It may tikkun olam because of tikkun olam. Meaning, Rav Shimon Gamliel, basically, just like we learned the Gemara in Gittin, applies this rule of tikkun olam, not only for your wife, but even for the first time, you cannot overpay. So, the Gemara says, now it comes out that according to Rav Shimon Gamliel, even if that means that her value is more than a ksuva, okay, right, it's always an uncomfortable discussion to talk about, the appraised value of a person. But, the Gemara says time and again, if we were to go on the slave market and if we were sold, so how much would we be valued at? Okay, so the Gemara notes a small discrepancy. So if she's taken captured, and they're asking 10 times more than the value of the ksuva. Pamri shana poda from the first point going forward, you redeem her. Meaning, like the Tanakama of the first brice we just saw this morning, you redeem her the first time, regardless of cost. Mikan ve'elach ratza poda ratza na poda. From that point going forward, it's optional. Rav Shimon Gamliel Omer, the reason why we're quoting this brice is for this opinion right now. Im haya pirkana kineged ksuva sa poda im lav in a poda. If ransom her is up to her ksuva, so then you ransom her. But once it exceeds her ksuva, so even the first time, you could just simply pay the ksuva. You don't have to ransom her. To which the Gemara says, fine, there's no discrepancy. Rav Shimon Gamliel, tre kula yishlei. Rav Shimon Gamliel has really two kulas, two leniencies. Don't ask the woman. The woman won't call this she won't call this a leniency. But from the husband's perspective, he's got two leniencies. Number one is that for the first time going forward, so he does not have to overpay her value. In other words, he has to ransom her, but only up to her value. Kula number two is, it's not an or, it's an and. And that's only true if what they're asking for her does not exceed the ksuva amount. But once it exceeds the ksuva amount, so then even the first time you have an option, you don't have to ransom her, you could just simply pay her the ksuva amount and be done with it as well. So Rav Shimon Gamliel actually has two kulas on this front. Continuing in the Gemara. Lakta chayv l'rufosa. If she gets sick, so you have to heal her. Remember, we had a discussion just the other day. Refuah, meaning the healing of your wife, that falls under the category of mizonos. Meaning that just like you have an obligation, a husband has an obligation to feed his wife, so also he has to pay for the medical bills as well. Tan Rabbana, aman nizonos menichsei yisomim utzricha refuah hareikim mizonos. So a widow. So remember now, when we talk about a woman being supported, we're talking about two stages of her life. We're talking about when the husband's alive, and when we're talking about when she's a widow. When she's a widow, the estate has an obligation to support her as well. So the brice over here is speaking now, not about the husband, but about the estate. Obviously, because it says the word almana. A widow is going to be supported by the estate, and if she needs to be healed, harei kimizonos, so that medical bill, it's filed under the category of food, and just like the estate has to feed her, the estate also has to pay her medical bills as well. Rav Shimon Gamliel, Ben Gamliel Omer, Rav Shimon Gamliel here also gives the estate a leniency, and that is the following. Refu sheish lakitzva nisrapes miksuvasa. If it's a fixed medical bill, meaning it's a procedure, it's something which is not, it's not therapy, but it's a one-time deal, so then she gets paid, but according to Rav Shimon Gamliel, that comes out of ksuva, meaning mizonos is an obligation on the estate to feed her, and it's a variable, and it does not affect her ksuva whatsoever, meaning that in the event that the ksuva is going to be paid out, so that's going to be totally unaffected by the mizonos. Mizonos that was given to her for the last year, 2 years, however long the estate was supporting her, obviously won't be counted against the ksuva at all. However, Rav Shimon Gamliel says, a medical bill that is not therapy, in other words, it's not go back and go back and go back, but it's a one-time deal, it's like a procedure. So Rav Shimon Gamliel says, that can be deducted off the ksuva. So when the estate does in fact pay her the ksuva, they're going to deduct this one-time medical bill. However, she'in la kitzvah arei kemezonis. Rav Shimon Gamliel says, if it's a therapy, meaning if it's something where she goes back to again and again, so then that's treated like mezonos, and that doesn't come off for ksuva. I'm Rav Yochanan asu hakasas dam beretzisof kerefu she'in la kitzvah. So Rav Yochanan says that hakasas is done bloodletting, the popular therapy of the Gemara, the bloodletting in Eretz Yisrael, so that's considered like therapy, and therefore it is it's not a procedure, it's not a one time deal, and therefore it falls under the category of mezonos. The estate has to pay it like they pay for her food, and that does not get her ksuva does not get deducted. So Krev de Rav Yochanan Havalei Isas Abba. So the relative of Rav Yochanan came to Rav Yochanan. They had the widow of their father. Okay. Could be they're talking about the mother. Now, it could be. I'd hate to think they're talking about the mother, but it could be. So, davetzricha refuah. So, but anyway, the point of the story goes like this. She needed a refuah. Kol yoma asala kamen derav yo, I'm sorry. Refuah kol yoma. She needed a refuah, and it was a daily refuah, so basically it was a therapy. And so, as we just learned, according to Rav Shimon Gamliel, which seems pretty clear from this Gemara, that's the halacha. So according to Rav Shimon Gamliel, it's treated like mezonos, and therefore the estate has to keep paying it, and the ksuva doesn't get deducted. Also coming to Rav Yochanan, Amar Lei, so they go to Rav Yochanan, and Rav Yochanan offers the following advice. Izlu kotzalu midi l'rofe. Why don't you do the following? Go find a doctor, and basically negotiate with the doctor. And look, it's a therapy, and she's going to come back day in and day out. But if you now negotiate with the doctor and basically say to him, look, let's make a contract. How much do you want right now? We're going to give you one lump sum payment right now, and then you'll keep treating her. But in other words, we'll file it under a one-time procedure. So I'm Rav Yochanan, I'm sorry, Midi LaRofe. Now, what do we gain by all that? Well, the relatives of Rav Yochanan gain now, because now that it's a one-time payment, so therefore it's going to be deducted off of her ksuva. And once the ksuva gets eaten up, meaning once the ksuva is paid out, so then the estate doesn't have to take care of it anymore. So this is what Rav Yochanan suggested to his relatives in terms of how to deal with the widow. Rav Yochanan realized what he just did. And that is, he gave them a really good idea. He did a little bit of fancy accounting, and he gave his relatives a good idea, and he didn't really advocate on behalf of the widow, and he felt bad. I'm Rav Yochanan Asinu Atzmina Korche Dayanim. So, and please, nobody take offense to this, or take offense either way. But we're going to ask you not to. But Rav Yochanan says, you know what I became? I became a lawyer. He says that, I advocated on behalf of somebody, and I knew the halacha well, and I really shouldn't have done that. So mikar myself lasof myself. Now obviously Rav Yochanan didn't feel that way in the beginning, meaning he obviously had regret of giving the advice, but at first he felt like, no, I should have given this advice. So me, Karisavar, me, Psarechalos, and Salem. On one hand, he felt, this is a family member asking me for what to do. So I'm going to give them the best advice I can give them. In other words, it's my family. It's like my boss. It's like my own flesh and blood. But then afterwards he says, yeah, but I'm Rav Yochanan. I shouldn't be advising people how to formulate a medical bill so that it files under ksuva and it doesn't file under mezonos. I'm an adam chashuv. I shouldn't be involved in all this. So Rav Yochanan ended up regretting providing. It wasn't wrong advice, by the way, mind you. It was good advice. It's just that, in other words, without his advice, they would have treated like mezonos. She would have gotten a continuous support from the family had Rav Yochanan not given the advice. Okay. Let's move on. We're up to the next mission. We're Nun Beis Amud Beis, and we are continuing. We are in the heart of the contractual agreements of a ksuva. Lo kasav la, and again, the basic point of the Mishnayos are, even if these clauses are not written in the ksuva, they are still binding. So we're learning what are the basic binding contractual obligations that exist between a husband and wife. Lo kasav la b'nin dirchun da'av lecha minai inan yarsin kesef ksuvasach yeser al chuka'on de'imachon. if he doesn't write that clause. Now, what does that clause mean? Ksuvas benin dichrin. We just spoke about this the other day, but here's the Mishnah. This is the Mishnah that actually speaks about ksuvas benin dichrin. And again, let's go over this one more time. It means as follows. When a woman gets married, so she goes into a marriage, the father writes a dowry. What kind of dowry is the father going to write? Well, it's his discretion. He writes whatever dowry he wants to write into the marriage. But let's go through his thought process. I'm going to write over a good portion of my estate to my daughter, and then what? She's going to marry a guy. Now they'll have children. And yes, it's true that my Yerusha will end up going to my grandchildren. But let's think about it. It may not be her only. It may not be his only wife. And my daughter may predecease my son-in-law. Which means then that my entire estate now is going to go to my son-in-law. Then what? Then my son-in-law may have other children from other women. And now my estate is going to go and leave the family. Okay, so in terms of asset protection, so, you know, people want their estates to stay in the family. The Chachamim knew this. The Chachamim understood this. And so, therefore, what the Chachamim did is the following. For every father who's going to write a dowry for his daughter to enter in the marriage, that dowry is going to get appraised, placed into the ksuva, and then, if she dies, so then the ksuva is going to go to the husband, but eventually, her children are going to be the ones collecting the appraised value of the ksuva before any division of the estate. Good. And once that happens, so now the father will go all the way back to the father-in-law, so he's going to write a nice dowry for his daughter, because now he's assured that whatever he writes as a dowry for his daughter, it's going to stay within the family. It will go to his grandchildren, and it will not go to any other grandchildren. This is the institution of Ksuvas Benin Dichrin. Now, basically, if we think about this well, you realize what the Chachamim are doing. They're really playing around with Yerusha. Meaning, that's not the law of Yerusha. The Yerusha is that when a man dies, so there's an equitable distribution of his estate to his children. And here what the Chachamim are doing is, no, it's not going to be equitable. Meaning, first things first, let's take a look at everyone's ksuva of their mothers. Every child is first and foremost going to get the ksuva of the mother, and then and only then are we going to make a division of the remainder of the estate. So really what the Chachamim are doing are they're playing around with Yerusha. Now, I'm not trying to be irreverent when I say play around, but I just simply mean that's not what the laws of Yerusha mandate. Okay, so I understand that this is a big deal, what they're doing with Ksuvas Benin Dichrin.
It's like with the firstborn, you don't have to give double portion before you decide, the father decides he's not getting it beforehand.
Well,
the fault is you get a double, but if you don't...
Correct. No, agreed. In other words, it's handled beforehand, but however, Ksuvas Benin Dichrin, as we'll learn later on, that basically what the rabbis did is they encased it in the laws of Yerusha, meaning... You'll see. You'll see later on. It's you know, they call it Yerusha. It's compartmentalized as Yerusha. Shiutzanai Basin. Okay, that's number one. Most of today we're going to talk about Ksuvas Benin Dichrin. So much more to talk about in this topic. Now, clause number two, contractual clause number two in our Mishnah. Benan Nukvan, the daughters, the Ahavan Lachaminai that you have for me, Yavin Yasvan Bevesei Mazanan Menechsai. They're going to continue to get supported by the estate. Meaning, if we have daughters, now they're obviously not going to inherit, but if we have daughters, here's what's going to happen. If you die, the estate is going to support the daughters until, we didn't read that part yet, until they get married. So, Chayv Shutanai Basin. Now, even if you didn't write that, that's also part of the contractual agreement of Iksuva, that the estate has to support the daughters until they get married. Next. You, meaning, right? He's writing to his wife the following in the ksuva. If I die, my estate is going to continue to support you during your widowhood. As long as you're a widow in my house. Now, when exactly does that end? When does the support end? So stay tuned, we're going to be discussing that. Chayev, even if he doesn't write that, again, the Mishnah makes the same point. He's still obligated to this contractual agreement, Shu Tanai Beis Din, because once again, this is part of Tanai Beis Din. This is part of the fundamental contractual agreements that exist between a husband and his wife. Kacha Yonche Yishleim Kosvin, And this is what the members of the city of Yerushalayim wrote, meaning the exact formula that we just saw. Now, up in the north, how do they write their ksuvas? Exactly like we just described. Anshe Yehuda, now this part's strange, because Yerushalayim is in the province of Yehuda. So why Yehuda would deviate from the ksuva, the way the ksuva was written in Yerushalayim, that part's a little bit strange, but anyway. Anshe Yehuda, Yukosun, Anshe Yerushalayim, Yerushalayim, Telach, Suvasach. Their formulation of the ksuva was a little bit different. And their clause went like this. You, the widow, are going to be supported by the estate until we pay you off with the ksuva. But once we pay you off with the ksuva, so then the estate no longer has an obligation to support you. And therefore, the Mishnah makes what seems to be the obvious conclusion, and that is that if the estate decides, you know, we no longer want to support the widow, so they can pay the lump settlement payment to the ksuva, and therefore terminate their obligation to have to support her. So there are two different ways to formulate this contractual clause of the ksuva. In other words, the estate has to support the widow. That's a given. Until when? So according to the Yerushalayim / Galo clause, until as long as she's a widow, living in the house of the deceased husband. Or two, the Yehuda clause, the way they write up the ksuva, until the estate decides to pay her the lump settlement of the ksuva. Okay. Amar Rav Yochanan. Mishum Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, mimnei matkinu ksuvas ben indichrin. Why did they institute ksuvas ben indichrin? So I already gave away the answer, but let's see it inside the Gemara. Kedei sheik v'atzadim yichsav lebito kavno. So the Gemara explains. I'll tell you why. It's because we're trying to incentivize the fathers to write a nice dowry for their daughter. Umi ikamidi derachmana amar bra leiros bartaloteros v'asur rabbanim umetakne deteros. So the Gemara says, what is going on over here? Meaning that, can the Chachamim do this? The Chachamim are really incentivizing the fathers to write off their estate to their daughters. Gemara says, wait a second, you know that the estate needs to be inherited by the sons. What are the Chachamim doing? So the Gemara says, I'll tell you what the Chachamim are doing. They're following the rules of the Torah. Barta Hanami Daraisa Udichsiv. Gemara says that marrying off your daughters is a big deal. It's a mitzvah d'oraisa for the father to marry off the daughter. This whole discussion that we're having right now is a complimentary discussion to the Gemara and Kedushin. We're going to see the Gemara and Kedushin at the end of Seder Nashim, so about a year from now. But there's a mitzvah of the Torah. It's not in the Torah, as we'll point out in just a second. It's a mitzvah of the Torah for a father to marry off his daughter. And if that means that he's got to write her a dowry, so he writes her a dowry. So the Chachamim are not ripping out the rules of Yerusha. They're also being compliant with the mitzvah in the Torah. The pasuk says, "The pasuk Yirmiyahu, k'chu nashim v'oli d'banim abanos u'k'chu levnechem nashim v'esbenosechem tenu l'anashim." So have children and marry off your sons and marry off your daughters. And bishlam abanim biyadei kaimei. Marrying off your sons, okay? So in other words, teach your son a profession, get him a good job, and he'll attract a nice girl. But elabante mi kaimei biyadei. But in other words, what are you going to do with your daughter? How do you marry off your daughter? How do you actively marry off your daughter? So akamash malan denabashem v'nechsei. So the Gemara says, dress her, make her look presentable, v'nesa v'lei midi, and also give her a dowry. So when you put all those ingredients together, so you're making her more attractive, so that's how you're going to marry off your daughter. The guys are going to gravitate towards her. Not exact translation, but you understand. And they're going to marry her. Okay. So the Gemara says what the Chachamim are doing are totally within their right, because by incentivizing the fathers to write a dowry for the daughter, so they're fulfilling a mitzvah of marrying off your daughter. V'ad kama, what is recommended? How much of a dowry should you write for your daughter? Meaning, how much of your estate should you be writing off should you be giving to your daughter for the marriage? Abay v'rav adar mitavaya ad le'isr nechseh. So up to 10% of your estate. Meaning, the Gemara over here is giving like a recommendation. Meaning, but no more than 10% of your estate. The Ema de Av Leiros de Bala Leiros. Gemara says like this. Look, remember what's included in the ksuva. Included in the ksuva is the settlement that she gets upon the termination of the marriage. Plus, she also is the ksuva also is in terms of its value, whatever the dowry represents. Wonders the Gemara. Look, here's what I do understand, but here's what I don't understand. I understand that when the father dies, so now the children of the already deceased mother are going to be inheriting before any Yerusha is done. They're first going to be inheriting the dowry of their grandfather, meaning their mother's father. So the Gemara says, that part I get, meaning that was the institution the rabbis made. Good. Here's what I don't understand. Well, before I say we don't understand, let's make sure that we're clear. Not only do they inherit the dowry of their grandfather, they also inherit that cash settlement of 200 and 100 zuz, depending on whatever it is, that's also contained in the ksuva. That 200, 100 was not gifted by the father-in-law. That wasn't part of the dowry of the father-in-law. That was an obligation that the husband made to the wife. So what we're learning right now is that when the father dies, the son is getting both values, both the value of the dowry and the value of that ksuva settlement. And now that we know that, now we totally understand the Gemara's question. I understand that we're getting the dowry of the grandfather. That was the whole reason of Ksuvas Benin Dichrin, to incentivize the grandfather to give a dowry for his daughter. So that now that the children are getting the dowry, perfect, that's exactly what the rabbis wanted. But what I don't understand, says the Gemara, is, and the Ksuva? Meaning, that wasn't from the grandfather. That was an obligation that the husband made to his wife. Why should they get that? Gemara gives such a fascinating answer. Because, again, let's go back to the beginning of the story. The father-in-law is sitting there and writing a dowry for his daughter. Right? And basically, you have to forecast a little bit into the future, but basically, the father-in-law is thinking like this. I'm going to write a nice dowry. He looks at his future son-in-law. What are you doing? What are you doing for the children, which I know my grandchildren, which obviously now we're at the marriage, you're not thinking about the grandchildren yet. I'm thinking about the grandchildren. But what are you contributing? Meaning, basically, right, a show of good faith. I'm going to contribute to my grandchildren's estate. What are you going to contribute? So basically, if the husband's 200 zuz that he promises to his wife, which she's entitled to, if he doesn't earmark that for the children, which haven't been born yet, so the father-in-law is going to look at that, and the father-in-law is going to say, well, if you're not contributing, I'm not going to contribute. So basically, it's there to help motivate and incentivize. It's like almost like matching. It's like matching gifts. Right, the father-in-law says, "I'll give, but what are you going to give? Okay, you're going to give the ksuva to my grandchildren, so I'll write even a larger dowry." The ema, back to the Gemara. So the Gemara says, "Okay, so then let's ask the next question, which is, let's say the father-in-law doesn't write a dowry. Does that mean that the children are able to inherit their mother's ksuva if there is no dowry in the ksuva?" Meaning, isn't the whole idea of inheriting the ksuva is because of the dowry? And if there's no dowry, so maybe the children aren't going to inherit their mother's ksuva. Lo plug Rabbanan, the Gemara dismisses that question with a very simple look. Once the rabbis instituted that the children are inheriting the ksuva, that's it. We're not going to then investigate, oh, this ksuva doesn't have a dowry, therefore the children are not going to get it. No, it's an institution. The children first inherit their mother's ksuva, and then after that point in time, then an equitable distribution of whatever the remainder of the estate is. Bas bena banim nami teros. Gemara says, why doesn't the daughter inherit their mother's ksuva? So kenachla shavir abanan. So the Gemara says, and Danny, this is what I told you was coming up, because even when the rabbis made this institution, they patterned it after already a Torah law, which is the laws of Yerusha. The laws of Yerusha say that the sons inherit and not the daughters. But that only begs the next question of the Gemara. Bas bena banas teros. So let's say there were only daughters. So if there were only daughters, so we know the halacha is that they're only daughters, they inherit the father's estate. No slavchan. So let's say they're only daughters. Did the rabbis institute ksuvas benin dichrin? Meaning, do the daughters of said mother first and foremost get their mother's ksuva, and then only after that point in time is there going to be a equitable distribution of the remainder of the estate? To that the Gemara says no. Bas ben abanos teros lo plug rabanos. So once again, the Gemara says over here, no. In other words, the Chachamim made only one institution, ksuvas benin dichrin, And on this, lo plug rabbanan, so it's one uniform law, and the Gemara basically said no. The girls are not going to inherit their mother's ksuva in addition to the regular Yerusha. The tigme memetaltalei. Now, this inheritance of ksuva has been indifferent. Only comes from real property. Why not from the movables? Because the rabbis also gave us the laws of ksuva, which means that we know that the ksuva is only collectible from real estate, from real property. It's not collectible from movables. So even though, yes, the sons of the mother are able to first and foremost collect the ksuva of their mother, but only from real property. So basically, now if we could just take one step backwards, if we look at this ksuva has been in dichrin, it's almost like a hybrid, meaning that the chachamim basically gave it two natures to it. One is that Yerusha, meaning that the Chachamim gave it a status of Yerusha, so that in the event that the father dies, so before we talk about dividing any of the estate, first and foremost, their mother's ksuva is going to go to them first as a Yerusha. As such, it only goes to the sons, not to the daughters. So in other words, first and foremost, it's treated like Yerusha. On the other hand, the Chachamim also gave it another nature as well, and that's ksuva. Ksuva, we know, is a contractual obligation, but only secured by real property. Ksuva's been indifferent also. It's only going to be secured by real property, and if there is no real property, so then the sons don't get ksuva's been indifferent. One more question to ask and answer. Titrosh mimishabdei. Two more questions. Sorry. Why not collect it from leaned properties? Meaning that, let's say, the father did have properties, but the father sold off those properties. So if it's ksuva, now we know the ksuva obligation is a collectible. And not only can you collect it from the estate, but if the estate sold it off, but if she had a pre-existing lien on that property, i.e., it was her ksuva, so then she can go and collect not only from the estate, but if the estate sold it off, she can go to the seller, she can go to the buyer and collect it from the buyer. So why not allow the children to collect the ksuvas ben indichrin from sold off properties? So the Gemara says yarsun tanan, because once again it's a hybrid, right? It's a very interesting institution. Even though the chachamim gave it the status of ksuva, they also gave it the status of yerusha. We know Yerusha is only assets on hand. Yerusha is, in other words, the children don't inherit sold off properties. So in that regard, we go back to the idea that ksuvas min dichrin Yerusha, and it's only for properties that are on hand. Ve'ema afagav deleka mosa dinar. One more question to ask. Ask the Gemara. Why is it? Now remember, we went over this halacha the other day, but we're going to say over this halacha again. Ksuvas ben indichrin affords the sons the opportunity to inherit their mother's ksuva prior to any allocation of any of the estate. But, let's say the father died with not that much money. And let's say if we were to divvy up everyone's ksuva, so there would be nothing left to divide of the father's estate. What's the halacha? Nobody gets ksuvas ben indichrin. Meaning, all the estate gets pooled into whatever it is, and then an equitable distribution of the estate to all the sons, and we don't exercise ksuvas ben indichrin. This is a halacha, we're saying it over again. The Gemara's question is a very simple one. Why? Why not? Meaning, if there's a legislation of ksuvas ben indichrin, first give the sons their mother's ksuva, the value of their mother's ksuva, and then, and only then, if there's nothing left, there's nothing left. The Gemara says, what's this halacha about? So the Gemara says, ve'ema afagav deleka mosa dinar, b'makom dekamiakra nachla d'oraisa lo tekin rabbanan. Gemara's answer is very simple. The rabbis didn't do that. Meaning, the rabbis didn't legislate to uproot a mitzvah in the Torah. Meaning, if there's going to be nothing left of a distribution of the Yerusha, so then the rabbis did not institute ksuvas ben indichrin. Period. Okay. So that is the very basic Q&A of this Takana Durabanan of Ksuvas Ben Indichrin. And with that, now we have a story. Rav Papa Yosek Lelebrei, Rav Papa's marrying off his son, Bei Abasura, and marrying into a family of Bei Abasura. And just as an interesting note, Rav Papa was wealthy. Right? The Gemara tells us a number of times. But it's not Rav Papa is marrying off his daughter, Rav Papa is marrying off his son. So now it's the other family, this Abasura family, who is supplying the daughter, and as we'll see in just a moment, the dowry as well. Azal mechta leksiva shama Yehuda bar Meremar nafek asa yitzchaz elei. So the Yehuda bar Meremar heard and stop by kimat lepischa. So now Rav Papa together with Yehuda bar Meremar are at the entrance of their future mechutanim. Well, Rav Papa's mechutanim. So havakam after minay, and Yehuda said to Rav Papa, "Look, you're about to go in to negotiate the dowry with your mechutan. So you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to excuse myself." Meaning, I don't want to be here for that part. I'm not family. I'm just a friend. I'd like to stay out of that. Okay, sounds like a smart move. So Amarle Neomar Behadei, Rav Papa insists to his colleague Rav Yehuda, "No, why don't you come in with me? I'd love it. Look, just, you know, it's not going to be so bad. Don't worry. You just come in with me." So top of Nun Gimel Amud Aleph, today's daf Chazit Olahavanichalei. But Rav Yehuda did not want to. Amar lei my day tech mishum da Amar lei Shmuel the Rav Yehuda shinana. Now Rav Papa says to his colleague, "Why won't you come in with me?" "Oh, I know why. It's because of what Shmuel taught his student Rav Yehuda shinana, the nickname of the nickname that Shmuel gives to his student Rav Yehuda. Lo te'ave ba'avure aschanasa. When someone's transferring your Yerusha, meaning transferring your Yerusha, meaning trying to bypass the laws of Yerusha, don't be involved in such a scenario. So, is that what's bothering you right now? Meaning, we're going to go into the house of my future mechutin, and he's going to be writing a dowry for his daughter. And anything he writes for his daughter is obviously estate that's not going to his sons. Is that what's bothering you?" So the Gemara says, "It shouldn't bother you. I feel me bra bishal bra tava." Oh, I'm sorry. I should have finished the sentence. "And even if somebody is trying to give over his estate from a bad son to a good son, still, don't get involved in that. Because, first of all, you're judging. Secondly, you don't know what's going to happen. Meaning, he may be a bad son, but he may produce great, great grandchildren." Right. Not, okay. Hopefully, you got the pause. And so, to which the Gemara says, I know that you think that you shouldn't be involved in any kinds of proceedings. The kosher came me brought labarta. And again, over here, what's happening is that my future mechutan is running a dowry for his daughter, and that means money being taken away from the sons. And you think that's bad, but it's not bad. Hainami takanta derabanani. As we've been discussing now for the duration of this morning, that is an institution by the rabbis that we're actually promoting. We're incentivizing the fathers to write a dowry for his daughter-in-law. Look, the whole legislation of Tzuvas Ben Indichrin is so that the father would write a nice dowry for his daughter. So it's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. So again, Rav Papa saying to Rav Yehuda, "So please join me." Meaning, you know, come. The Amr Rav Yochanan, Mishum Rav Shem Amar Yochai. Okay. Amr Lehani Milimi Daite. Lasuye Name. So Rav Papa still trying to politely refuse the invitation. Wait a second.
Not Rav Papa delegate.
Huh?
Rav Papa is not refusing the delegate.
Rav Papa, I'm sorry, you're right. I'm sorry, thank you. Rav Yehuda is politely refusing Rav Papa's invitation. And Rav Yehuda says, "Look, here's what's going to happen. I'm going to go in there, and I'm basically going to coerce your future mechutan to write even a nicer dowry." Amar le, so Rav Papa says to Rav Yehuda, "Atu mikamin elachta ova asiso ova lo ta'asiya." No, I'm not asking you to come in and say anything. I just need a little bit of companionship. You'll join me. You don't have to, I don't want you to say anything. So asiya kamina. Amar le ma'ale adidi hainu asina. So here Rav Yehuda shows tremendous self-awareness, and he says, "Look, I'm intimidating, right? I'm going to go in there. Even without me saying a word, your future mechutin is going to look at you, he's going to look at me, and the check, you know, the zeros, he's just going to keep writing more zeros at the end of the check." Achve va'ol. And oddly enough, the story is going to take an interesting turn. And so Rav Papa pushes and pushes and pushes and finally gets Rav Yehuda to come in with him. Okay, so now let's paint the scene. Rav Papa, Rav Yehuda in the house of the Rav Papa's future mechutin. And Rav Papa is providing a son, the future mechutin. Again, let me say his name. Abasura. So Abasura is providing the daughter, and now Abasura is, they're negotiating a dowry. Ishtik v'yasif savaru mirsas rasach. And now, just such a great scene. So now Abasura is writing the dowry, and he keeps looking up. And he sees not only Rav Papa's Mechutin, but he sees now Rav Yehuda. Now Rav Yehuda is not saying anything. And by instruction, he's not saying anything. But when someone's sitting there not saying anything, what does that mean? So in your mind, that can mean a whole bunch of things. So Abasura is writing the dowry, and every time he adds another zero, he looks up to see if Rav Yehuda is satisfied. He's not. Well, he doesn't know. Rav Yehuda's not saying anything. And so, what an interesting turn to the story. So then, he writes, Abasura writes, his entire estate over to his daughter as dowry, hoping to satisfy and appease one Rav Yehuda. So, Lesof Amalei Hashanam Elam Mishtaymar. And now, finally, after all said and done, he is exhausted. Literally, financially, he's exhausted. And he looks over to Rav Yehuda and he says, no, I can't get anything out of you now. Not a smile, not even right, nothing. Meaning, I just wrote over my entire state over to my daughter to appease Rav Papa, but really to appease you, and nothing out of you yet. Chai Damar, Lo Shav Gemidi, Lanav Shei. Oh my God, I didn't leave anything for myself. So Amarlei, Imi Naididi Afilo Hainami Dikasavta Lo Nichalei. So finally, for the first time, Rav Yehuda opens his mouth, and Rav Yehuda says the following to Abasura. He says, look, if you asked me from the beginning, I wouldn't have wanted you to write anything. Now, I don't know what anything means. I mean, in other words, maybe some dowry, but certainly not to give your entire estate over to your daughter for a dowry. I never would have wanted you to do that. So Amalei Hashanami Adabi. So Abasura says, good. So can I retract? Meaning, I know I wrote the ksuva. I know I agreed to that ksuva amount. But now that, to the dowry, I should say. But now that I know that you wouldn't have wanted that, can I at least back out now? So Amalei Shavinafsha Hadrana Lokamina. So Rav Yehuda says to him, no. Because then, you know what people are going to call you? A Hadrana. They're going to call you a retractor. Meaning, you make a commitment, then you can explain, well, I didn't mean it. That wasn't a commitment I really meant. And so therefore, people are going to call you in a Hadrana, and I don't want people to call you that, so I'm suggesting that you stick with that. Story ends, period. What happens after that point in time? Who only knows? It's a great story. I mean, great meaning, you know, I don't know if Abasura would say it's great, but just, you know, the parties that are involved, you know, the communication, lack thereof communication, it's an interesting story. Okay, let's wrap it up. Let's summarize, and then we'll continue tomorrow. Okay, we finished the story. We finished the discussion in the Gemara regarding redeeming your ransom, your captive wife. So again, the halach is that you have to redeem it the first time. Machlok is the first time between Tanakama Rishim and Gamaliel, but the Tanakama says that even if they're asking for 10 times more than her value, so you are contractually obligated by the ksuba to redeem it that first time. After the first time, so then it's optional. And if you don't want to redeem her after the first time, so then you pay out the ksuba. The mizonos that you pay her after your debt, meaning the estate has to pay the mizonos, the estate also has to pay for the medical bills as well. We made a distinction in a halacha between a procedure and therapy, and we had a story with Rav Yochanan today. And then finally, we started the new Mishnah on Nun Beis Amud Beis, talking about other contractual obligations of ksuva. And today we really focused on ksuvas benin dichrin, a legislative establishment made by the Chachamim to incentivize the father-in-laws to write a large dowry for the daughter. And the way they did that is by assuring that estate goes to his grandchildren, to his daughter's children, before any other division of the estate of his son-in-law. And we got our heads wrapped around the idea that ksuva's been in dichrin. The rabbis treat it like a yerusha, they treat it like a ksuva, so it's got some halachas that are yerusha-like, they have some halachas that are ksuva-like, and then we finished off today with a great story of Rav Papa marrying off his son to Abasura and the writing of a dowry.